Hey everyone, welcome to Beyond the Bio. We're glad you joined us today and are excited to share a series that will not only dive deep into the stories of our exceptional leaders at Bain, but get into how we work together and how we aspire to be better as a firm through our operating principles. These core principles are what produced our outstanding results, empower our teams, and fuel the reason why we're consistently recognized as the best place to work. Join us as we break down our five operating principles through the voices of guests who live them in their everyday lives and in their careers at Bain. Joining me today on the show is Ivan Hineshaw, our regional managing partner for the Americas and a leader in our full potential transformation and results delivery practices. We'll be continuing our series talking about the operating principles, with this episode focused on Guided by True North. As we define it, Guided by True North means we do the right thing always. We are open, honest, and direct. Today, we'll learn about why this operating principle is so important to our business and Ivan's journey through Bain and his advice to other Bainies. Ivan, welcome to Beyond the Bio. Thanks for joining us.
Excited to be here, Keith.
So we're going to flip things up a little bit on this episode and start by talking about the big topic of the day, which is Guided by True North. Before we talk about your Bain journey, let's spend a few minutes talking about that. Now, I know we coined this term in the early 90s, but can you give people a background on how this came about and what it means for us?
I've been at Bain a long time, Keith, so over 30 years, but I will admit I was not around when we created these operating principles. But when I joined Bain in 1993, Guided by True North was definitely one of those things that when you start, you're told, hey, this is a really important part of who we are and how we operate. And I think basically what it means is, again, it's as you said it, we do the right thing always. It means we do the right thing by our clients. It means we do the right thing by our people. It means we do the right thing by our communities. And fundamentally, I think that's what allows Bain to be the special place it is just it's always committed to doing the right thing for people, communities, and clients.
So let's talk about some examples there, because it's one thing to say it, but when you see it come to life, it really does stand out to you a little bit. Maybe we could start with a client example where that's been a relevant operating principle for us to lean on.
I'll give a couple of examples. One of them is the business of Bain, and part of the reason you always do the right thing is that you end up building a relationship with a client because you do great work, you do the right thing by them, and then in an ideal world, whenever they have a problem again, they give you a call and they say, hey, come and help me out again. And that's usually a great thing, but occasionally what happens is you have a client that leaves one company and we're doing great work for them and it's creating great results and returns, and they go to a much smaller company. And I'll share a story, a CFO of a client, leave one client, go to another, and he called me up and he was now the CEO of a business at about $100 million. And he said, Ivan, hey, we'd love to hire you to go and do this work. And the reality is when I started doing the math with him, I'll use the name John, it wasn't John. I'll say, John, I really love that you called me, but you're a $100 million business, and if we help accelerate your growth rate by another 10%, that's an extra $10 million this year. If I think about your margin structure and then how much it's going to cost you, you're not going to make money this year, and we're still going to be struggling to get break-even next year. And so let me introduce you to somebody that can do this for a lot less money than we're going to charge you. I would have loved to work with John. I know we could have done great work, but it just wasn't a good use of their money. And so that's just one example, Keith, of True North. Happy to share others.
Yeah, I know I had worked for a small $300 million company in Michigan, and they're working for a business that was probably half their revenue. And there were some really tough decisions on the table, and they wanted us to come in and basically validate their strategy. And we said, well, we're not going to come in and rubber stamp it. And more importantly, it might be time for you to sell the business that's been in your family for 100 years. And if all things aren't on the table, then we're probably not the right firm for you, because we're not just going to come in and take the revenue and say, you know, yes, you're doing great, good luck to you.
Yep, absolutely. And to your point, being True North also means having the right conversation, not the easy conversation. And so to talk to a family-owned business, right, and talk to them about exiting a business, yeah, that's the right thing to have, even though if it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, it was tricky, but I think we earned a lot of respect from their leadership team for taking a good stand on that. And we ended up doing great work for them multiple times. Now, you mentioned two other dimensions of this, you know, people and communities. Maybe you could share a little bit about that, because I think people can understand, like, yeah, you have the tough conversation with your clients and you tell them what the right thing is, whether or not they want to hear it. But how does that translate into people and communities here?
Yeah, I am at Bain. I've been at Bain as long as I have, because I do fundamentally believe it's the best place in the world to work. Yes, I'm a homer. I've been drinking the Kool-Aid for 30 years. You'd expect me to say nothing else. But in order to be a great place to work, you have to attract the best talent. You have to develop the best talent. You have to retain the best talent. So what might seem like a tough trade-off, I'll give you an example. You've had someone who's been at Bain for 2 years, they're really, really good at one thing or a specific thing. And the easiest thing would be to keep them going on a client. They maybe been on this client for 6 or 9 months. And the easiest thing for us and the client would be just to have this person go do this same thing one more time. But it just wouldn't be right for their long-term professional development. It wouldn't be right for their career. It wouldn't be right, candidly, for the long-term of Bain. And so in those situations, you have the tough conversation a lot of times with the partner and say, hey, sorry, so-and-so actually needs to come off this case. As you know, Keith, I was the office head in LA for a while, and I still remember we had a few tough conversations with partners where they'd say, hey, if we take this person off the case, we're not going to roll the case. I'd kind of look at them. I'd probably tilt my head a little bit to the side a little bit. And I say, so now you're a partner. You're telling me if we pull the senior associate consultant off the case, you can't roll the case? I know they're valuable and everything. We do have amazing people, but I trust you as a partner being able to pull that off. But that's the conversation you're going to have with a partner and to explain to them why you're taking someone off their case.
Yeah, and I remember having those conversations. I did staffing probably 15 years ago in Chicago. And with the partner team, it was always like, so you're telling me that if they left Bain right now, we'd lose this client? They go, no. I said, okay, well, pretend they left. Let's start thinking about life afterwards. But you know, the other side of that is just as true, Ivan, which is people come into Bain or come into consulting probably and say, I want to do nothing but tech. I'm like, okay, but we're trying to have you be a general manager. We're trying to have you be the chief executive at a company, not a functional expert for your whole career.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, Keith. The way I often think about it is there's this grid, right? It's a bingo card. You've got industries on one axis. You've got capabilities on another. And by that, I mean growth and cost reduction and maybe M&A, all the different things you need to be able to do with operations as an executive. And I encourage our junior people to try to fill as many of those things out as they can. A, it makes you a better general manager. And I think the other thing that people often don't realize is, and I did a lot of work in consumer products. I've also done a lot of work in pharmaceuticals. And I've had a client who's the CEO of a pharmaceutical company, and he very clearly knows that his company and his industry is in all likelihood not the best in the world at R&D, at operations, at sales, at marketing, at functional delivery. And so the ability to be able to talk to a pharma company about how consumer packaged goods companies think about marketing and engaging consumers is completely additive. It just allows you to bring in a different perspective.
Yeah, and I like that part of our model and helping people understand that that's actually valuable early in their career is hard. You and I both started in a hyper-generalist Bain, I like to say in the late 1900s. I'm really grateful that I had a chance to fill out a lot of that bingo card as an AC. It set a really cool foundation for later in my career.
Yeah, you also realize that industries have cultures too, not just companies. And the things that certain industries, you go into consumer packaged goods and those companies really value marketing capability. And so there's a certain type of person oftentimes that's really great at that. You go into a technology company and they value technical skill. And a lot of times that's a little bit different. And so it's a really great way to get exposure to not only what are different companies like, but what are different industries like. And as I grow in my career, and where might I be interested?
Yep, absolutely. Now, the third thing that you talked about was communities. And I know Bain is very involved in the community, both through our social impact practice and other local efforts at the office level. But what does Guided by True North mean from a community engagement or community standpoint?
Yeah, for us, Keith, it's just a commitment to sustained impact. We made a commitment in 2015 to give back over $1 billion of consulting resources over a 10-year period. And we're going to exceed that target. So we're very, very close to the exit. We're going to exceed that target by the end of next year. It's easy when you've got excess capacity to say, oh, we'll go and support this, we'll go and support that. It's not easy when you're really, really busy. And if you look at various points over the past couple of years, particularly 21, the first half of 2022, we stayed committed to making an impact in a few key places on environment, education, healthcare, racial equity, and social justice. So we committed talent and we stayed committed with that talent, even as we got busy with clients.
What's been interesting to me is to see us do good and do well at the same time. We had Sasha Dusnowski on the podcast, and he talked about the work he did, I think, with the Nature Conservancy in the Marshall Islands. And he was talking with, I was asking him, yeah, how have you been able to keep doing social impact work? Like, it's really hard to be a partner when you only want to work for clients that don't pay us in cash. And he said, well, actually, the stuff that I'm learning there and the models that I'm developing there directly translate to the commercial side.
Right. And I think a lot of our partners would say that social impact side, that not-for-profit side, allows them to get the balance of energy that they get for working on the for-profit side, right? So they really do think about doing good and doing well at the same time. It gives them that balance.
I also know it's really hard when you have a high-priority corporate client that wants a team and you say, look, we don't have one. And you know you have teams invested in the social impact work that we do.
True North. Got about True North. Clients, people, and our communities.
What I think most people don't notice is that our logo is actually sort of a nod to True North. So it definitely predates me. I didn't realize it predated you, but it's been part of our logo from day one, hasn't it?
I think it has, yeah. So if you look at the logo, people for a long time thought it was a Northwest Airlines logo, but they're not around anymore, so we don't have that brand issue anymore. But it's a slightly tilted compass because, again, the idea of True North is a compass. And Ari Gadish, one of our longest-standing partners, very, very impressive lady, the board of our business, would tell the story of you use a compass to navigate True North, and True North is not always a magnetic north. Compasses can get thrown off, and so don't allow your compass to get thrown off. And that's the logo.
So Ivan, now that we've covered Guided by True North as an operating principle, I want to take a step back and talk a little bit more about your journey at Bain. I mentioned in the first part of this that you joined in the late 1900s like I did, but let's start a little bit before that. Where did you grow up and what was your upbringing like? Did you know that being a management consultant was your destiny as a young child?
Yeah, I was born and I grabbed a PowerPoint, Keith. That's not a true story. Where did I grow up? Tricky question, actually. So my parents were born, raised, educated in England. My family's originally English all the way back till at least the 1700s. We ran out of tracing back at that point. And my parents decided when they got married, they wanted to travel the world. So I was born in St. Kitts in the Caribbean. Was only there for about 6 months. Then I lived in Kenya for 7 years. Then I lived in England for about 6 months. Moved to Philadelphia for a couple of years, where we actually bought our first television. And I'm not that old. That was 1979, by the way. It was not 1959. We bought a television to watch the Olympics. It's, I guess, 1980. But spent a lot of time in California. And my dad had a master's degree in nematodology, which is bugs. And we followed the world of bugs.
Really cool. Now, Ivan, what did you want to do when you wanted to leave home and go to college? What was the plan? And was it sort of set from an early age, or was it something that sort of emerged as you grew up?
Now, I moved, as you could probably tell, given all those, I moved a ton, Keith. And so the first time I really remember thinking about career was probably in 10th grade. My parents' businesses had, you know, both entrepreneurs were going through a bit of a downspell. And we'd moved so I could go to a good school district, but we were living in an apartment. And I kind of looked around and I had a great upbringing, great parents, but I wanted a little bit more stability for myself, to be honest. And at that time, when I looked around, my parents had a friend and he was a lawyer and he seemed like he had a good life. He had a nice car, he had a nice house. So as a sophomore in high school, I thought, sweet, I'm going to be a lawyer.
Sometimes it's just that simple. So you end up staying in California and going to school in the UC system at Berkeley. Was that essentially a pre-law step for you?
Yeah, it was. So it turns out this person that was my role model was running a law firm and I interned at his law firm. Starting in high school, I entered there every summer in college, and I was a first semester senior in college, just getting ready to apply to law school when I happened to get invited to this Bain information session. And since then, things have been different.
Things are certainly different. Now, did we lure you in with the promise of free pizza and soda like we did when I was in school?
Pretty much, yeah. It was here's a focus group, there'll be food and drinks. You may as well come. I don't know. What else do you need more than that?
As an undergrad? Not much. Not much at all.
Not much.
Maybe dessert. So do you end up going through the process, obviously, and coming to Bain as an AC? So I have to ask, who were the people that you met at that event that made you take such a right turn in your career, given that you had been on a multi-year path towards becoming a lawyer?
I met two people in particular. One is Ed Lynn, who's still at Bain today, just like me, but he's been here 31 or 32 years. And another one was Jim Gray. And I always had a view that when I left school, I wanted to learn. I wanted to be surrounded by great people and interesting people. And I just really liked Ed and Jim. And I thought about, well, gosh, if I'm going to work hard, I may as well be around people I really like. And I really like Ed and Jim. And then I met a few more Bainies and I liked them too. And I thought, wow, this could be something. And then there's the variety to go work in a bunch of different fields and industries. So I, in addition to free pizza and some drinks, soda, by the way, because I was 20, I applied to Bain.
And so I have to interject here because I have had a chance to meet Ed several times on my trips to Asia or different leadership team meetings. And I can totally see how meeting him, you go, well, what does he do and where does he work? Because if he fits in there, this could be a really cool place. And then I might have shared on an earlier episode of the podcast, but Jim Gray was one of the managers I had here in Chicago before business school. And I am not exaggerating to say that some of the advice and coaching he gave me when we were working together was absolutely pivotal in my career. It was one of those moments where you go, I'm going to be okay, because if someone like him has confidence in me, sky's the limit. And Jim was hugely pivotal in my development here, which is really funny to hear his name come up in this conversation.
It's a small world. Jim's a great guy.
So Ivan, you come to Bain for a couple of years, like a lot of us. My guess is, I won't even ask because nobody plans on staying 30 years. Let's get into business school, which you did. Was the plan to come back to Bain after business school?
You know, it's interesting. I actually accepted my offer to return to Bain before business school. Now, I went to business school at Stanford in 1997, and I'm not sure how many of our audience will remember what was happening in Silicon Valley in 97, 98, 99. But it was absolutely bonkers. And so part of the reason I wanted to come back to Bain is I loved the people I was working with. I was learning a ton. I knew I had a lot more to learn. And I just said, well, gosh, they're going to pay for my business school. Why wouldn't I come back? But I do remember sitting down. I had 30 of my classmates decide not to come back for their second year of business school because the options they got in their summer of 1998 were so valuable so quickly, they just said, forget it. I'm not coming back to business school. And so I sat there and I looked around and I said, okay, I'm committed to going back to Bain. Should I really go back to Bain? Or is that, you know, because you could write a business plan on a napkin and get funded. And I looked around and I said, well, I didn't have a huge idea that I felt really good about, number one. Number two, I looked around and I think some other people were just really smart and excited about what they were going to go do. And candidly, again, we talked a bit about my kind of financial background and desire to create security. I just didn't feel like I could afford to be on my fifth failed.com at 35. And so I was probably a little bit risk averse, to be totally honest. And so made the call to stay, made the call to kind of stick through with that commitment. And I probably didn't look very smart between 99 and 01. And then at one point in 01, when the market just blew up and exploded in the wrong way, that felt a little bit better. I looked a little bit wiser, perhaps, than I really was.
It's too funny. You know, I left Bain in a similar sense. You know, I have two engineering degrees in electrical engineering, and all of my friends were, frankly, just transferring to the Bay and becoming millionaires like a week later. Just put .com on the end of anything back then, and off you go. And I remember being there when the bubble burst and coming back, and it was really interesting to watch from a distance. But those were really crazy times. I'm glad I made the decision to come back as well.
Yeah.
So you came back to Bain after business school, as did I, and you took on a couple of other leadership roles. And I want to spend a few minutes talking about those because we've had several servant leaders on the podcast, both office heads and leaders of practices, et cetera. And I always think it's interesting to hear how they thought about their role, frankly, leading their peers. You know, it's not like CEO of a company where you get to call the shots and from the top down, the edicts come. It's a lot more of a support role, and it's enabling great people to do great work. I like to say, you know, Bain has great athletes. Our goal is to let them play, let them score, let them win. And how did you approach the first big leadership role that I'll point to here as the LA office head? It was a relatively new office at the time. I think it's only been a couple of years old at that point.
Yeah, so the office was founded in 1996. I took over the office head role. I originally actually made the decision to go down there. And this is just something throughout my career, the role of mentors has been massive. You've mentioned a few of yours, Keith, that the big reason I went to LA in the first place was because a couple of my closest mentors in San Francisco, Russ Hagee, Fred Studier, Rich Burks, and Mark Howarth, were all moving down to LA to create, hey, we're going to refound this hotbed, we're going to recreate this culture. And the culture and the vibe and the energy was amazing. It's great in all Bain offices, candidly, but there's a difference between 500 people and 30. And there's pros and cons to both, but I was super excited to go down to LA. Really happy I went down. I was surrounded by people that really took care of me, invested in me, developed me, helped me become not just the business person I am, but the person I am. So I was very, very excited to head down there. And then Russ Hagee stepped away from the office head role in end of 2006. He became our chief talent officer. And there was an opening, an opportunity, and I had the opportunity to take it. And I still remember my wife saying to me, I'm not sure if you want it, but I know you well enough that I'm pretty sure if you could do it, you're not going to want to watch someone else do it. So yeah, I think you should go for it.
It's funny, you know, the names and the overlaps for those people listening who are trying to piece together Bain's org chart by binging the podcast. Russ is also the person who hired me. I worked with Russ probably half the time I was a partner and an LT member in Chicago on multiple clients. And I went to ask him about taking a sabbatical at one point, and he said, actually, instead, how about you do this recruiting job? That was 10 years ago. So either Russ has an eye for talent or he just likes to take careless risks with the business. I'm not sure which it is.
I love it.
Ivan, what were some of the challenges or missions that you had as an office head in LA? Because I remember LA started the year I joined, as did Atlanta, I think. And for a while, it was relatively small. It's a big office now. You know, was it about scaling? Was it about attracting talent? You know, how did you think about building that culture in LA? I know we like to make fun of you all as enjoying the LA weather all year round and fun in the sun, but I know it was a lot of hard work down there.
Yeah, it's interesting. We got together as a leadership team when I came into the role in 2007, and we collectively put our heads together and we said, our ambition is to be the business advisor of choice in the Southern California region, built upon a network of people that are promoters of Bain. And notably, it wasn't just the best consulting firm, it was the best business advisor. So that was our ambition. What made it really hard, Keith, and you know, you mentioned that we joined when Bain was much more generalist. We also joined even back in 2007. It was much more, it still has an office-centric model in terms of culture and that sort of thing, but we really resourced all the way up to partner even in 2007, 2008, 2009, based on local. Your first question wasn't who knows this industry. Your first question was who's down the street. And it was, I tell you what, LA was tough in 2000. If you think about the number of companies leaving LA, so we had a very, very difficult issue where five of our biggest seven clients from the first 10 years of our office being open left California. So that was tough. Like, I didn't anticipate that was what I was going to be dealing with when I came into the role, but that and then the financial crisis in 2009, it was an interesting first few years.
I would say. Now, the good news is we promoted you out of the LA leadership role so we could get, I think Tina was your successor in there.
Big upgrade.
To keep things going. But you took on a role as regional managing partner for the Americas, which again is a bigger servant leadership role. And how did that change your perspective on the firm and the culture? Because now it's a much bigger set of offices with different sets of challenges, but arguably the same culture and the same objectives and missions.
Yeah, and just for the listeners, so what's my team? Who's my team? How do I think about my job? And so as a regional managing partner of the Americas, again, we think about Bain as an upside-down pyramid. And so my job is to support the practice leaders in the region and the office heads in the region, supporting their partners and teams and supporting their clients. So that's the scope of the role. The three things that I thought about when I came into the role, and so I'm now in year five. These tend to be 2 times 3-year terms, so probably another year in the role. Number one is deepen our relationships with the clients by doing the right thing all the time. People always ask me, and I give a lot of career advice on, and the advice I always give is always choose balance sheet over income statement. And what I mean by that is if you do the right thing and if you build promoters, if you build people that really like working with you and appreciate the impact you have, income statement will follow. And I still remember talking to a client one time and he told me the story and he said, I had a relationship with another consulting firm and some things changed. And at that point I realized he just thought I was a paycheck. And this is a CEO of a big company talking about another partner, another consulting firm. And that was just reinforced it is it's all about building that balance sheet. So for me, it was how do we build a balance sheet of clients, of stronger clients where we've done more work, better work, stronger relationships, number one. Number two was, and I still feel this, right? I've got maybe a year to go. I had to leave this role with the belief that was the same belief I came into it, that this is the best place to work in the world. And so making sure no matter what we're doing and what turmoil we're dealing with, and oh, by the way, there's been a lot of it in the last few years, this is the best place to work. And then the final part of it was just our ability and the realization that how we do that work has to change through technology. And so it was just a combination of number one, doing more with clients, number two, making sure we continue the best place to work, and number three, making sure we adopted how we delivered that value through the adoption of technology.
That's really great. And as somebody who's been here for that journey, both before, during, and I guess in a year or so after your leadership, all of those things have been true. And it's been really neat to see our growth as a firm, especially the technology adoption. One of the silver linings of COVID, there are very, very few, was that it forced a lot of us to learn a lot of new technology really quickly.
Yeah, it's been remarkable. It's been amazing to see the team's done an amazing job.
So Ivan, as we start to wrap, we've now had a chance to talk through almost 30-year career for you at Bain. And I want to bring our conversation back to True North. How should people at Bain or other business leaders listening to this think about what it means to be guided by True North on a day-to-day basis? I think there's big decisions where you're like, okay, this is one of those moments of truth, but it's the little things, I think, along the way. And how do you integrate True North into your day-to-day actions so that you make sure you're doing the right thing always?
Boy, it's hard to, it's such a tough question to answer, Keith. And I look back at it and just, it's probably just asking yourself a few different questions. On a personal level, when I'm making decisions, is this a decision I'm going to feel good about in 1 year, 3 year, 5 years, and when I'm 95 years old looking back on my life? So just making sure you're making decisions that will stand the test of time. With a client, it's asking yourself, am I having the easy conversation or the right conversation? We are hired to help our clients create change and to help their companies be successful. We're not hired to have nice, friendly chats all the time. And so it's asking myself, am I doing the right thing? Is this what I would be doing if I were saying, if I were the CEO of this company? And so I think it's just all those little reality checks. And I think the final thing on this is, you know, I've got a personal purpose statement. I don't know how many others in the audience do, but my purpose statement, unapologetically in order, right? Number one, enjoy life and better the world by building a happy and healthy family and self, and by supporting others in their pursuit of fulfillment and happiness. And I think at the root of it, probably the most important thing on any question on True North is, are you being true to yourself? And I'm always asking that question when I make my decisions. Is this consistent and aligned with my own personal purpose statement and the impact I want to have in the world and how I want to be remembered? It's an ongoing journey. And, you know, do I make mistakes? Yes. Am I always perfect? Living True North? No. Why? I try, though. I try.
Ivan, I really appreciate you sharing that. And it's just one more thing we have in common. Everybody who's come to our house has seen the Bevins family mission statement literally posted and framed right next to the front door when they come in.
I have not been to your house yet. I got to check it out.
It is a good reminder for us of what we're supposed to be about. And we don't always get it right, but we're always trying to be. So thank you for sharing that today on the podcast.
Absolutely, Keith. What's the statement? Can you read it to me?
Oh, it's long. It's got about seven. It's got okay. About seven or eight different parts to it. I'll send you a copy. But Ivan,
send me a copy, or you invite me to dinner. Either one, I'll take either.
Well, Ivan, I want to thank you for taking time today, and thanks for sharing your story and a little bit about our operating principles.
Thanks, Keith, for the time.